Blog Talk Radio.
To an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. We're not here so much to tell you about the future as we are to encourage you to think about your future and to consider what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that will occur in your life, in your world, the one that begins with recognizing and acting on the vast possibilities that are unfolding before you and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. Excited about this show tonight. It's one of my favorite subjects to talk about.
Well, you know, we're bouncing around. This is bouncing around very nicely. Last week, Dangerous Visions. This week,
yep.
Optimistic science fiction. So, you know, we're recovering from our
opposite end of the, flip side of the coin.
Exactly. And last week we weren't talking about science fiction, but we had the cover from that Harlan Ellison collection, Dangerous Visions, which is probably the least optimistic set of short stories probably ever collected, unless someone ever put a collection together specifically of, I come to think of it, they probably have, dystopias
downers.
And horrible downers. But this is a nice lead up actually to our program next week, which we're going to be talking a little bit tonight about Zoltan Istvan's book, The Transhumanist Wager. But that's what we're going to be all about next week, because Zoltan is going to be with us to talk about that. But Giulio and I, in our interview, which we'll be getting to in a moment, get into it a bit. And too bad you weren't with us, Stephen. Time zones being what they were, we had to interview Giulio in the middle of the workday, and work intervened as it does sometimes.
That's right. It was just one of those deals where I could not break away as I had intended to be a part of that interview. But I know it'll be awesome. Giulio is fascinating guy, and you're a good interviewer yourself, Phil. So I'm sure it'll be awesome to listen to. So looking forward to that. We allotted a little extra time tonight to talk about some of these things ourselves too.
Exactly. So we made it a 90-minute show since I knew you'd be free. You know, probably at 10 o'clock your time. So we'll just we'll take an extra half hour, and you can chime in on some of this. Take notes, you know, as you hear what Giulio and I have to say, and then you can set us straight.
Here, Giulio, you ignorant. No, I wouldn't say that.
No, not at all.
No,
that's
it's
Phil. Okay, not Giulio. So let's be clear on who's who on this show.
Yeah. Okay.
So before we get into the interview, because it's a lot of fun. Well, actually, before we even get into my update on the world transformed, the world's longest book. Anything interesting going on in your life? Anything you want to share with us to start us off this evening?
Well, I've we've enjoyed around my house here the last few days, just kind of a slow build up to Halloween. My kids are the right age now to be able to appreciate the not really scary, gory stuff. I don't like that stuff myself. So, you know, I'm not pushing that on them. But you know, they're old enough to really appreciate, you know, some of the classic, Frankenstein, Dracula, you know, the old Universal monster movies and stuff. And we've watched a few of those, and then watched a few other things like The Village, which is M. Night Shyamalan before
right.
he crashed and burned. And we've had some good times watching that, and it was funny. Matthew comes up, like last night, and says, "Why haven't we done this every Halloween?" I said, "Man, you guys are just the age to appreciate this, you know."
Right.
You're like,
right.
"I can't believe you withheld all this awesomeness, you know." Well, you can appreciate it now, but a couple of years ago, you would have been you know, burrowed under the couch, you know. So it's the right time to enjoy that stuff with them. So that's been fun.
You know, I just saw, speaking of that kind of thing, I think over on Instapunt, Glenn had put a link up for it was like a one-day sale of the complete Universal Monster Collection on Blu-ray. And
That's what I did. I took that link and went to it and purchased here. We've been watching those Universal movies.
Oh, okay. So those original Universal. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, Creature from the Black Lagoon and Wolfman and all those movies. And I was going to give that to my dad.
The Invisible Man, Black Lagoon, and the Frankenstein. And so
exactly.
You had a good time. Yeah.
I was going to get it for my dad, and I realized he doesn't have a Blu-ray player. And I'm like, oh, then I'll have to buy him the player. And, you know, it suddenly became this thing, and I decided against it. But everyone, I think, should have that collection of movies for sure. And you know what? They were. It was weird. It was like that one-day sale, and it was a lot more expensive on DVD. So now I'm holding out. I know they'll run the one-day sale on the DVD version eventually, and I'll snatch it up then. But anyway, very cool. All right. Well, good. Happy Halloween to you and your family. We haven't really done much with the approaching holiday, so I'm glad you mentioned that. Now, shifting gears. Oh, I'm sorry. Something else you wanted to say on that?
No, that was it.
Oh. Let's talk briefly about the world's longest book. For those of you who haven't been keeping up, we are publishing a book. We're publishing an e-book online. It's called The World Transformed. It's a collection of world-transforming ideas. Everyone in the world is invited to participate. Everyone in the world is invited to submit an idea that they think will transform the world. To launch the project, we're publishing an abridged edition of the book, which will contain 99 world-transforming ideas written by people who are friends of ours, people who've been on this program, or people that we're otherwise connected to or otherwise think would be interested in participating in this project. We've been tracking over the past month and a half or so our progress on lining up the 99 authors. Our goal was to have all 99 lined up by the end of October. And, Stephen, it is October 30th, and I'm here to tell you that I've got 93 names accounted for on our author list. So,
a miserable failure.
Six by midnight tomorrow. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I quit. I resign.
93 is
project
awesome,
is off.
Particularly the caliber of people involved is just incredible and an exciting project. So yeah, 93 we'll get. You know, the good thing is we can kind of at this point, you know, begin moving towards writing our parts of it now. You know, it's we kind of shift gears from promoting it in some ways to actually writing and participating and bringing this about now. So that's awesome.
Well, you know, one of the things that is most exciting for me about this is that some people have not waited. You know, we've told them that the deadline is the end of the year, and it'll probably be extended beyond that. And we'll come out with an official communication on that, I'm sure, in the very near future. But people have been submitting their ideas to me already. Some in just very rough outline form, and some people have been actually writing up the drafts. And I'm going to start sharing these with you as well, Stephen. But some really interesting and exciting ideas that people are coming up with, stuff, you know, as far removed from each other as geoengineering and digital government. Okay, people talking about why we need to stop recycling, which is going to be an interesting argument, to people talking about why there needs to be a basic income. Kind of the Martin Ford idea of how the government needs to be paying us all. Now, the interesting thing about that is some of those sound like familiar ideas, but we know from the rules of the program, the rules of the submission guidelines for the book, that these will all be new spins on each of those ideas. So even if it's an idea that sounds familiar, when you read this, you're going to be reading a completely new way to go about doing those things, a new approach to digital government or to whatever the alternative is to recycling or to, you know, any of 99 different things in the abridged edition. It's going to be great. It's going to be great fun, not only getting to read those, review those, and get those put together into book form, but it's going to be great fun for us, Stephen, talking to each of those authors about their awesome ideas right here on this program, which happens to bear the same name as the book.
Absolutely. So It's going to be fun. We will, you know, it's the sort of thing we'll be able to roll out over the next 10 years. You know, it's just one of the, you know, there, obviously there will be a publishing date, you know, in 2014. But it's the sort of thing that we can continue to go back to and bring people on the show. It is the future of this show, and so we're
let me give a little spoiler to our interview with Julio Prisco, which is pre-recorded and we're coming up here in just a moment. We get to talking a little bit about this book, about The World Transformed, in our discussion of optimistic science fiction, and a new idea emerges, which might be our next big project after The World Transforms, Stephen. So you'll want to listen closely to that and see what you think about that idea.
Okay, sounds great.
And that, with that in mind, maybe we just want to go ahead and bring out our interview with Julio, and then we'll come back afterwards and talk some more optimistic science fiction.
Sounds great.
We're always pleased to welcome Julio Prisco to The World Transformed. He is a writer, a technology expert, a futurist, cosmist, and a transhumanist. A former manager in European science and technology centers, Julio writes and speaks on a wide range of topics, including science, information technology, emerging technologies, virtual worlds, space exploration, and future studies. And I should say also on the subject of science fiction, which is what we'll be talking about today. Julio, welcome back to The World Transformed.
Thank you very much, Steve, for having me back, and too bad that Stephen is not with us.
Well,
I hope between you and I, we will manage to make it entertaining enough.
Yes, Stephen, we'll get to listen in, and I'm sure he'll provide his commentary at a later time. So we're talking today about optimistic science fiction, and there was a piece on IO9, simply asking people to give good examples of optimistic science fiction, and you had linked to that and written a piece wherein you named some good, solid examples of science fiction that takes us in an optimistic direction. And I thought it would be fun to spend some time this week just going through our favorite examples of optimistic science fiction, and also talk about maybe some examples that aren't as optimistic as others. And before we do any of that, let's just take a moment and step back and say, why does it matter? Why is optimistic science fiction important? In your view, do you think it is important? And if so, why?
I think it is very important. And I would also say that science fiction has to be optimistic science fiction. Let's think about what science fiction is. And perhaps let's not use example of today, but rather examples of old science fiction, what is called Golden Age science fiction.
Okay.
That has been something incredibly important, I believe. Because even though looking back at it from today, we may find it not scientifically sophisticated enough,
right,
or we may find it not up to the same very high literary standards of today's science fiction. What was really beautiful in Golden Age science fiction, I'm mainly talking of the 50s, 60s, 70s,
yep,
up to the 90s, what was important is that it could really excite the imagination of people.
Right.
It could really inspire people with beautiful visions of what can be made possible by science. And look at what these people did. They went up, they built the space program with the Apollo moon landing in 69, they
right.
went up and they built the internet technology in the 80s. They did a lot of wonderful things, and I think in many cases these people decided to become scientists after having their mind put on fire by science fiction. I know many people who decided to dedicate themselves to science for that reason, and that is the reason why I myself decided to become a scientist instead of something else. And this has been an extremely important thing and has had an extremely powerful impact on different generations. And even so, the vision of the future that were commonplace in Golden Age science fiction do not exactly coincide with the future that we can see now around us. I think it cannot be denied that our world, as far as the impact of technology is concerned, is being directly built as a result of the fact that Golden Age science fiction had an enormous ability to get people inspired and excited by science.
Oh, I think so. You know,
science fiction, you know, is that thing that really makes you wake up in the morning full of energy. You want to do something. If
right.
you're a scientist, you want to do something with science. You really want to do something that helps building the future that you like to read about in science fiction. And I think that is an extremely important thing. I am afraid the science fiction of today, even if it's more scientifically sophisticated of all science fiction, and is also very often much better literature, is not as effective in accomplishing this very important mission.
You know, I agree, and I think that has to do with the second question we'll get to in just a moment, which has to do with why an optimistic vision seems to be so hard to come by these days. But before we jump to that, let me just agree with you that that the Golden Age of science fiction produced this very positive view of technology, very positive view of humanity using technology. And it showed us as a species, as a civilization, on this upward arc that that I don't think you see in fiction so much as much as you used to. You see it now more in kind of some, you know, singularitarian or transhumanist thinking, right? That nonfiction people write optimistic visions of the future. But I remember when I was a kid, I was a big fan of Robert A. Heinlein. He had written these novels for kids about space travel. There was one called Between Planets, another one called Red Planet, about a kid living on Mars. And by the time I was reading them in the 70s, early 70s, they were already a little bit outdated because I think they were probably written in the 1950s. And they were already giving us a somewhat outdated view of what space exploration was going to be like and how we were going to move into space. We were already kind of, you know, closing down Apollo and sort of moving away from some of those things. But even a vision that you had to take with a little bit of a grain of salt, that you had to apply a strong, willing suspension of disbelief to, could be so powerful because it showed things working out, right? It said, well, here's a future where we get into space and we're doing effective things there, and you know, we've only begun. The story of humanity is one that's just starting out, and pretty soon we're going to be going into interstellar space, and we're going to be having lots more adventures. And it was just a great introduction to science fiction, but also to science for a lot of kids. And I think another thing that came from around that time period is the original Star Trek TV series. You talk about people being inspired by science fiction to become scientists. I've heard a lot of people who are in sciences say that that they got their idea or they got their motivation to become scientists specifically from watching that TV show. So yeah, I agree. I think that just having a positive vision of the future seems to be one of the things that that most strongly propels people to wanting to go in and make a difference. But let me ask you. Let me just challenge that for a moment. Wouldn't negative or pessimistic views of the future also inspire people to want to go in and change things, to, you know, save the planet or that kind of thing? Or do you think that's less of a factor?
Mm, it's definitely less of a factor for me. It's a different kind of inspiration. Now, I know that different people are motivated by different things. And, of course, there are people who are easier to motivate with fear. You know, you do your best because you don't want that something happens, and you want to do your best to prevent that from happening.
Right.
But other people, and I would say most people, I certainly belong to this category, are easier to motivate with the hope and the hope in positive outcomes. I don't do things very much for fear.
Right.
You see what I mean?
Absolutely, yeah.
It's a different
kind of motivation.
Reactions of different people. And, of course, we need both. There are many different things under the stars, and I believe that is a good thing. But I do insist on the importance of positive, you know, solar, optimistic science fiction as a very powerful motivating factor for a wide, I think, class of people to which I do belong myself.
You know, I think if anything, that maybe the dystopian futures, the pessimistic views of the future that you see, because I go back to my childhood, and I think of some of the earliest impressions that I have from science fiction movies. When I was a kid, there was this series of Charlton Heston films. Right? He was in Soylent Green, which was probably the most realistic of the three I'm going to name, and not terribly realistic, but the most realistic of the three. And big spoiler for anyone listening who's never seen the movie, the environment's being destroyed, and it turns out in the end the people are feeding on each other. It's really kind of the sad end of the world. And then there was Omega Man, which is kind of the zombie apocalypse of the early 70s, and just he's the only guy left and fighting off the zombies. And then there was Planet of the Apes, which is the most ridiculous of the three, but it's, you know, far-flung future where humanity has become enslaved by our ape masters. Now, none of these, I think, were particularly instructive. I guess perhaps Soylent Green, the closest to being an instructive view of the future, because it warns about, global climate apocalypse, I suppose. But they were all massively entertaining. And I wonder if maybe dystopian, pessimistic futures work better as entertainment, oddly enough, escapism, strangely enough, because they put the protagonists into such dire situations, and that just makes for a lot of action and makes for a lot of kind of entertaining scenarios.
Well, I understand what you mean, but at the same time, I would say that if you want to look at a dystopian universe, you don't really need science fiction for that. You can just watch the world around you. You can listen to the news. All these things that are featured in dystopian science fiction, I'm afraid, are things that we are beginning more and more to see happening in the real world around us every day. So that if that's my entertainment, I don't need science fiction. I can get that from CNN. but the real point that I want to make is that if you are motivated by fear, like all this talk these days about existential risks, dangers of technology, what can go wrong, what bad things can happen, if you are motivated by fear, what you want is to make sure that things do not happen. So you fight against something. You don't fight for something.
Right.
You say no to genetically modified organisms, no to artificial intelligence, no to extremely advanced neurotechnology and mind uploading. You say no. You never say yes.
Right.
And at the end of the day, there is one very easy way to make sure that the things do not change. And this way is to do nothing at all. Let's stop scientific investigation, let's stop science, let's stop technology, let's go back to the world of our grandfathers. But that doesn't work. That doesn't create any positive change. And at the end, I think it's the most dangerous thing that we can do at this very moment is not doing something to change. So that I do believe in the importance of optimistic science fiction to motivate you to dedicate your ability, your energy, your skills, or effort in favor of something, because you want to see something happen. The scenario in, you know, the, if you think of the penetration of golden age science fiction in society,
mm-hmm.
you see all these very young kids, teenagers, who read pulp magazines.
Right.
And, you know, they were excited. They wanted space. Let's go to space. Very soon, it will be possible to go to space. We will go faster than light. We will visit other stars. Then they decided to become scientists. And at that point, they could understand that things are not so easy as depicted in science fiction, that if our current understanding of physics is correct, we are not going to be able to go to the stars faster than light.
Right.
But the excitation and the motivation was already there. Of course, they did not develop faster than light space propulsion, but they did develop other things. And they developed these other things because of the extreme excitation that the science fiction of their time had given them.
Right. Well, with that in mind, so let's think about that. So optimistic views of the future, particularly as portrayed in fiction, being so efficacious in moving us forward and getting people inspired, getting them excited about the future, why, then, is the official future, as seen on CNN and elsewhere, always so bleak? Why are optimistic visions so hard to come by? Why is optimism so out of style, as it were?
But I don't think that optimistic visions are hard to come by.
Okay.
Rather, I would say that optimistic visions are out of fashion.
Mm-hmm.
It's very sad, but it's a fact. I can think of two different reasons for that. And one, you know, if you think of the last couple of decades and remember how optimist we were in the 90s. I mean, in the 90s, we had already came back to Earth from space.
Right.
We were very sad because of that. But we had this new thing. We had the Internet. We had cyberspace. We had John Perry Barlow's declaration of the right of people in cyberspace. You know, all these things were happening. Things were moving. The result is the Internet that we have now. And we were very optimistic at that time. So the question I ask myself is what happened to stop this wave of optimism, and what was the starting point? You know, I really believe that the turning point was September 11, which had a very deep impact on our society,
right.
Perhaps much deeper than we could understand at that time, of course, especially on the American-U.S. society, but I would say everywhere. We came from a very optimistic phase. The 90s were a very optimistic decade.
Yes.
You know, everything was possible. Science was developing, not only the Internet, but nanotechnology, and we were advancing in the human genome project. We were beginning to think about advanced neurotechnology, you know, all that, and there was an excitation in the air. There was a lot of energy in the air. We thought to be immortal and invincible. Nothing bad could happen to us. Of course, September 11 was a very striking demonstration that very bad things can happen indeed, and that perhaps we are not as safe in our own home as we thought we were. And so the tendency has been some kind of withdrawal from optimism and imagination. This is an important factor, in my opinion. And another important factor, which I think is loosely related to the first one, is that these days in liberal intellectual circles, between scare quotes, optimism is not fashionable anymore, and dystopia is very fashionable indeed.
Right. Yeah, I think I hadn't thought of September 11th as kind of a turning point, but that makes a lot of sense. And I've always looked for what happened between the 90s and today that put us on this course. And it should be a fairly obvious answer now that you mentioned it. I'm like, oh yeah, that should have occurred to me. Here's another factor.
One of many things, of course, but I think September 11 had a strong symbolic value,
mm-hmm.
and symbols are more real than bricks, and they can be very important things.
Absolutely. Here's another possibility, and I wonder if you might want to comment on this. It seems to me that technology has enabled and accelerated a kind of discourse, a kind of public discourse that we didn't have before. That we've always had, but maybe it's happening faster now, and it's driving, and the technology is helping drive it in directions that it might not have gone in times past. But I call this mimetic tribalism, and it goes to this idea that the memes that went out, the ideas that went out, are always the most extreme. And since we're always pitting the good guys against the bad guys, everyone within the political establishment is kind of triangulating against the other side and attempting to describe the biggest possible threat. They're trying to put the other side into the most negative light possible, giving the most negative scenario possible, because those are always the stickiest, and those are always the ones that people respond to the most. So you have this kind of, you know, race to the bottom in terms of who can be the most within standard political discourse, who can provide the most bleak view of the future, the scariest view of the future that they claim only they can provide the remedy to. But you spend very little time on the remedies. You spend most of your time talking about how bad things are going to be if the other guys get away with what they're trying to do. What do you think? Do you think there's a factor of that?
Unfortunately, yes, and I believe it's a very dangerous thing. Just think of the history of the last century.
Mm-hmm.
There have been moments in history where the political establishment has been mostly motivating people by fear.
Mm-hmm.
And think of what these historical periods have been. I think the answer is very clear. One example was in Germany and Italy in the 30s. And we all know what happened.
Right, right.
Unfortunately, it is very easy to motivate people by fear. The economy is going bad because of the Jews.
Right.
They are stealing our jobs. They are stealing our homes. They are stealing our money. What happened after that? This shows, we should always study history, because it's always a very good guide to our times. Things do change, but they don't change that much. I think the important lessons from history remain valid. And I think the lesson we can learn from the worst things that happened in the last century is that you should not motivate people against something. You should not motivate people by fear, because we know what happens in those cases. We must motivate it, we must, I believe, motivate people with great expectations of very positive outcomes, so that we can give the people the motivation to actually do something to convert these imagined positive outcomes to actual reality. And here we are back to the fundamental importance of optimistic science fiction, you know, that it's not only about science fiction. It's about a much wider context. The same things apply to politics, I think. Science fiction is a good example. It's not the only example. And we could make we could have a basically equivalent discussion in a different context.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that science fiction does for us, good science fiction, particularly the kind that you're talking about that presents an optimistic view of the future, is it speaks to our core common humanity. Even as something as simple as, you know, the bridge of the Starship Enterprise was this very international place, particularly for like 60s American TV. That you know, you had
yes.
you had a Japanese guy there, you had an African American lady, you had a Scottish guy, you had a Russian guy. It was the future is about we discover our common core humanity, or we transcend things that are differences between us today, because there's something more fundamental that's driving us ahead. Whereas the rhetoric of fear, as you mentioned, it goes in exactly the opposite of that direction. It's all about dividing humanity up so that we can get traction off the fear that we have of the other to get power, right? Not really to propel anyone ahead, not really to move anything ahead, but just in some sense to make whoever's putting that fearful message out to get power for that individual or for that group. Science fiction always, it seems to me, good science fiction always pushes in the other direction. So let's, you know, we've talked around this enough. Let's get into some examples of optimistic science fiction and talk about why they're important. And I've got a few of my own. I've peppered a few in here and there as we've gone. But let's talk about the ones that you wrote about on your blog. And I will be sharing the link both on worldtransform.com and in the chat room as well. But the first one you mentioned, what I thought was very interesting, was Childhood's End. And you also talked a little bit about 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Yeah, but hold on one moment. Childhood's End by Arthur C. Clarke is a great book. It's really a great one.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it may be the only book of Arthur C. Clarke which is not an example of optimistic science fiction, because so it is a great book. It is really one of the books that I like, that I love more.
Mm-hmm.
It is not so solarly positive as the other works of Arthur C. Clarke. I think if I have to pick books of Arthur C. Clarke as examples of optimistic science fiction, this is the last one that I would pick. And it has come into discussion because it was mentioned by the readers of IO9 as an example of optimistic science fiction. It's not really the case, I believe, but it's still a great book. And everything else that Arthur C. Clarke has written, I think, can be considered as an example of optimistic science fiction.
Well, you know, I think that if you look at the progression from Childhood's End to 2001: A Space Odyssey, I've always seen Childhood's End as almost kind of his first draft of 2001: A Space Odyssey that accidentally got published as a novel in its own right. You know, in terms of what the story is about and where it's taking humanity. And then when he wrote 2010, the sequel to 2001, which was also made into a movie. And people get wrapped around the fact that, you know, the one movie was a Stanley Kubrick classic and the other one is just this kind of 80s adventure story. But there you see the progression go even further. And you truly have an optimistic vision of humanity's future tied in with kind of joining this sort of universal civilization that that already exists.
It's one of the things that we shouldn't really stress the difference between 2001 and 2010 and the following books, because I mean it is impossible to write a sequel to 2001.
Yes,
2001 is. I mean, if you ask me what is the best science fiction book ever written, I won't have any hesitation. I would say that 2001 is the best. And since we were also talking of film, I am very much persuaded that when it comes to science fiction film, 2001 is not only the best science fiction film, but even though it dates of almost 45 years ago, I believe it is the only really good, really great science fiction film ever done. So that, you know, 2001 is a class in itself.
Absolutely, I agree.
It cannot be compared to anything else. But also the other books of Arthur C. Clarke, for example, I don't know if you have read The Fountains of Paradise. No, that's a great book.
Right.
It's very standard. Arthur C. Clarke, you know, it shows a civilization which begins to venture into space, and we have solved many of the political problems of today's world. So we start moving into space. In that novel, they built the first space elevator, which will facilitate further expansion into space.
Right.
And then the solar system is visited by an artificial intelligent space craft sent by another civilization, and we have a dialogue with the aliens mediated by the probe in the solar system. You know, all these things happen, always with a very positive and very solid vision of the future. And at the end of the book, we get visit from this alien civilization. They come to the solar system in a huge spacecraft, you know, and the book leaves you really with great expectation. If this is going to be the future, then I want to be a part of this future. And even if I cannot be a part of this future myself, then I want to do my best to make sure that the children of my children may be part of it. You know, this is really the kind of very positive, great expectation and excitation that the best science fiction can give you.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, one other by Arthur C. Clarke that I think made your list, unless I'm misremembering, was In Light of Other Days?
Yeah, The Light of Other Days. That is something that Arthur C. Clarke wrote in collaboration with Stephen Baxter.
Mm.
And as a matter of fact, it has the same title of a science fiction book of a few decades ago. I don't remember who was the author of the first one at this moment. But you know, this is very different. Now, what happens in The Light of Other Days is that scientists discover that, you know, the fabric of space-time itself is full with micro wormholes. So that there is a kind of a data link between each pixel and of space-time and every other pixel of space-time. And, of course, initially they use this invention for snooping and for news reporting.
Right.
This is a very obvious application that you can think of. But then they discover that the technology also works across time. That, you know, like you can see in real time what is happening now at the other side of the world, you can also see in some kind of real time what was happening 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago.
Right.
And the end of the book becomes really the most optimistic vision of the future that I can think of, because they find out how to use this warm cam, that's what they call it,
mm-hmm.
technology, to scan the content of the brain of
people in the past,
alive in the past,
right.
hundreds or thousands of years ago. So they find a way to use this technology together with the mind uploading technology that they have developed in the meantime to resurrect everybody from the past. And, you know, really things, you cannot really be more optimistic than that. You have a technology, nothing mystical, nothing magic, nothing supernatural, that is actually able to resurrect the dead from the past. That's so extremely optimistic that, you know, it really makes you happy to be alive in a universe where similar things can happen. And as we discussed the last year when I was here at the show for the first time,
mm-hmm.
There are those who are based on this and other examples, not only in science fiction, but also in real science, have developed new scientific religions fully compatible with science. But, well, they, we are getting off topic, I'm afraid.
Well, not entirely, because, you know, what you find in the meeting point, I guess, between the most optimistic of science fiction and scientific and religious visions is this transcendent point where everything is possible, where all the problems can be solved, where we've actually moved into this completely different mode of existence. And you know, last time we had you on, the title of that show was The Physics of Immortality. We took the title from Frank Tipler's book, wherein he talks about exactly this thing, right? He talks about a future wherein humanity is resurrected. So, yeah, I think it's probably...
Yeah, he talks about a different technological implementation
right.
of the same central idea. And the central idea is that sometime in the future, science may be able to resurrect the dead.
Absolutely, yeah. So that's... That is as optimistic, I think, a vision as you can have. And it reminds me, oddly, of you had mentioned Diaspora by Greg Egan. Another,
yes.
I find all of his stories, most of his books, even the ones that present kind of bleak things happening in the future, to be optimistic just in the sense that he embraces these vast possibilities. And one of them that that I really enjoyed is Permutation City.
Yes,
the story.
That's a great book.
Fantastic story all around uploading minds and, you know, what happens with the copies. One of the ideas that he outlines in there that I had never heard of before, and I now know to call by its name of, I think it's called quantum immortality, quantum suicide. It just sort of happens by chance to one of the characters that we follow in the book, which may or may not have any basis in reality. We may find that something like that is real, or we may find that the universe works in a very different way. But fiction that embraces possibilities that vast, that talks about you know, us moving from one universe to another, moving from one mode of existence to another. As you mentioned, just the idea of humanity becoming sufficiently technologically adept that we can go back and recapture the past, we can resurrect the dead. It seems to me that envisioning that level of capability is inherently optimistic, whatever's happening in the story.
It definitely is. Now, in Diaspora, you have a vision of a humanity, I mean, not even that far in the future. The story begins 1,000 years in the future.
Right.
And what happens is that most of humanity have decided to undergo mind uploading and become an incorporeal civilization of software beings.
Right.
And the reason why I find that book so optimistic is that, you know, you see that even if they are not living in flesh and blood anymore, they are living as software in virtual scapes and supercomputer, they are still human beings. They are still like us. I mean, they love each other. They have a life that you can definitely relate to our own life.
Right.
So it is not like, you know, if we become, with mind uploading, you know, we become machines, we lose what is the essence of being human. No. In this novel, Greg Egan shows that we can have such a radical change of how to call it, the hardware implementation of human beings without really changing what is important. The essence of being human is still there.
Right.
In the character of diaspora, and everybody can see it. So I feel that very inspiring and very optimistic. And now, Greg Egan has also written another two books, maybe not exactly in the same universe, but it could be the mm-hmm. same universe, or at least it's a very compatible universe. One is called Shield's Ladder,
okay,
and the other one is called Incandescence.
Mm-hmm.
These could be seen as sequels of Diaspora, but even farther away in the future. I mean, we're talking now of 20,000 years in one case, and in the second case it may be millions of years, where there is a civilization of uploads spanning the entire galaxy. And they are still very nice guys, and we can definitely relate to them as well. And these are very optimist visions.
Yeah, they're still human. That's the interesting thing. At core, these are still people that you can relate to, even though they're spanning intergalactic space and living. Well, is Shield's Ladder the one? I don't mean to spoil it for anyone, but this doesn't really spoil it. But is that the one that essentially goes to the end of time? Is that the one, or am I thinking of a different book?
I think none of these two books goes to the end of time.
Okay, all right. One of them goes a long way, or maybe not. I might be thinking of some other story that's similar.
What you could see as going to the end of time is Diaspora in the epilogue. But no, these books happen in the future, but mm-hmm. not at the end of time.
Okay.
Now, coming back to what you were saying about the fact that Greg Egan can also write not very optimistic books. In fact, I think one of the examples that you had in mind is Zendegi.
Mm-hmm.
It's an Iranian word, so I'm not sure if I pronounce it right. But anyway, it's a novel of 2008, I believe. I wrote a review on that one.
Mm-hmm.
That is the story not very far in the future, the 2030 or 2040s, about the early development of mind uploading technology.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's it doesn't have a very optimistic end. It's actually a tragedy, because it ends up with the death of the protagonist, who is one of the first persons to test a very preliminary form of mind uploading technology. So it is not very optimistic. The author knows very well that, you know, the development of new technologies is never so simple as we may think at the beginning. I mean, science fiction is good because it gives us a good a vision for things that can be done. But then when you want to actually do that in practice, you always run into roadblocks, and you may have to take a side tour, you may have to go back. Things are never so simple and never so linear as we might wish.
Right.
And they always take much more time than you hope at the beginning. Now, when you think of technologies like mind uploading that can have a very deep personal impact, then it becomes evident that in the first phase of the development of this technology, there will be very bad things that happen,
right,
and there will be tragedies at a human personal level.
Right.
But even that book ends up with hope. One of the main characters is thinking to herself at the end of the book, and she thinks something like, okay, it didn't work as I would have wished this time, but it may work in the future, and sooner or later, humanity might conquer death, which is a very optimistic end of the book. And as a matter of fact, if you think Zendegi can be seen as a prequel to Diaspora, the universe in which the two books happen can be the same, and Zendegi shows the first very difficult phase of the development of the same mind uploading technology that then makes Diaspora possible.
Interesting. I'm going to have to, I have not read that one. I've read Diaspora, but I think what I'll do is I'll read those back to back. Read one is
I'll send you a link. I'll send you a link.
Please do. That'd be great. Okay, we got a few minutes left, and I want to touch on kind of the move towards more singularitarian, more transhumanist themes in fiction. We've seen some great stuff over the years from Cory Doctorow. I look at a book like Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, which has a, I think, in many ways, very optimistic view of the future in terms of we see a society that's post-scarcity and post-mortality and post a lot of things that we really want to get,
yes,
get post. And even the book Makers, which I view as kind of a sequel, or excuse me, a kind of a prequel to Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, which shows economic collapse occurring. But what's happening during the collapse is people are finding new ways to function economically. People are making these shanty towns that sound better than the housing a lot of us have in this world. And it's a really interesting interplay between negative things happening and kind of a positive response of humanity to deal with those things.
I love Cory Doctorow books very much, but he's not one of the first authors who would come to my mind when thinking of optimistic science fiction.
Right. It's more like optimistic themes that occur within, not necessarily optimistic stories, I guess, is kind of...
It has an optimistic side, of course.
Let's look at kind of an emerging subgenre within science fiction, which is post-human or transhumanist fiction. And two books in particular that are on my mind because they've been the subject of recent or soon to be in the future, actually next week's shows. We reviewed on The World Transformed Nexus by Ramez Nam last year, and
it's a great book.
Love that book, and just spoke with him about Crux just a few weeks ago, the sequel to that. And on an upcoming show, I've got Zoltan Ishtar.
I have also written a review of that.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll make sure we get the link to that up in the chat room. Looking at The Transhumanist Wager by Zoltan Ishtar. Now, here's an interesting dichotomy, I think, between these two stories. And I don't want to spoil it for anyone. I'm not going to talk about the end necessarily. But as we mentioned in Crux a few weeks ago, you have the beginnings of a war, essentially, between humans and post-humans. And what's going on in Crux is the people that we sympathize with the most, the people that we consider to be the good guys in the story, the heroes in the story, don't want this war. They would like to prevent this war, and they want to mitigate it to the extent that it's possible, versus The Transhumanist Wager, wherein the protagonist is actually calling for a war between humanity and transhumanists. Now, I don't consider a coming war between humanity and posthumans or transhumans to be a particularly optimistic scenario. I consider it, far from an optimistic scenario. I think that there are a lot of scenarios where we don't have that happen at all. But what do you think? Is that a theme that we just need to keep dealing with as a cautionary tale, or is it time for some transhumanist fiction that doesn't presuppose that there has to be a conflict with bloodshed?
Well, this idea of a coming conflict between humans and post-humans is basically the scenario of Hugo de Garis in
right.
The Afterlife War.
Right.
I cannot entirely rule out that some scenario similar to that one will actually happen, because it is the fact that, you were thinking of Ramesh Nam's books. Huh?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And in these books, you really see that the level of hostility to what we can call transhumanist technologies can become very, very high indeed.
Right.
And from Nexus and Crooks, you can see that, the people in power can really resort to whatever kind of measures, including murder and genocide, to prevent that from happening.
Right.
Now, that's not something that I would wish to see, but when it comes to violence, if it comes to violence, what I would do is to do my best to protect myself. So, I think, I cannot say I think, because I'm not sure. Let's say that I hope that reasons will eventually prevail on both sides. And I think Nexus and Crooks are two good examples where, even if there is a lot of violence, there is also a lot of reasons, and we are left with the hope that reason will eventually prevail. Well, we have to see what happens in the third book, which Ramesh
Absolutely.
Should publish next year.
Looking forward to that, yes.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to that, because that's going to be a great book. In fact, Ramesh Nam's books are two books that I do recommend to everyone. And here I want to take advantage of that to come back to a point that you were making some time ago and we have left aside, which is the difference between fiction and nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as you know, Ramesh Nam has written a nonfiction book a few years ago. It was called More Than Human. It was a scientific analysis of the technologies on which Nexus is based.
Right.
Of course, since the book was written like 7 years ago, I believe, in the meantime, science has advanced a lot. And it was a very good book. I have enjoyed it a lot. But, a fiction book is something that you enjoy much more.
Mm. It's more entertaining, yes.
It's more entertaining as it stays in your mind better. If
mm-hmm.
something is entertaining, you learn things without even realizing that you're learning things. You learn things because you learn them on the way in your enjoyment of the book. So I think fiction, in this case science fiction, is also much more effective than scientific writing in order to communicate scientific concepts. And that's one more reason why I think good science fiction is important. We can actually learn science much better if we also read science fiction. Now, you were mentioning Zoltan Istvan, The Transhumanist Wager.
Right, another story that deals with the conflict between humans and transhumans, but...
Yes, that's...
In a very different way.
Yeah, that's another book that I have reviewed, And last week we had a video discussion with a few people who have read and reviewed the book, and Zoltan Istvan himself. The discussion is on YouTube. It was organized by David Wood of London Futurists. Maybe you can also link to that one.
We will definitely include that link as well, for sure.
It's kind of instructive. Now, the point that I'd like to make about the transhumanist wager, which has received a lot of praise but a lot of criticism as well, is that it's not the same kind of book of, for example, a Nexus. In a Nexus, you have real people.
Mm-hmm.
In whereas the transhumanist wager is more like an...
They're archetypes, aren't they?
An epic novel.
Yeah.
They're more like icons.
Yeah. Yeah.
Symbols. Than real
than people. Yeah.
And, you know, it has to be read without forgetting that it's basically epic literature. It is a story of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, besides the main character, Jethro Knight, and you were saying that you'd like to have Jethro Knight himself on the show.
I'd love to interview Jethro. Yes, I have some questions for him.
Really great, but I would advise that you interview another one of the characters of the transhumanist wager. You should really interview Jethro's girlfriend.
Absolutely. I'd love to talk to her. Yes.
She has a completely different attitude. She's what I would call a spiritual transhumanist. And she believes in all these things that we are we were discussing, of you know, the unlimited possibilities of consciousness in a quantum universe, including the fact that future quantum technology may be able to resurrect the dead from the past.
Right.
Which is a I mean, the thing is that even Jethro Knight's agrees on this point. He even wrote a paper, it's a fictional paper, of course, one in the book, outlining some future technology that may actually be able to resurrect the dead based on some kind of quantum awareness.
Right.
So he's not against the spiritual interpretation of the world, transhumanism and technology.
Mm-hmm.
He just wants immortality now.
Right.
He wants it right now in his own lifetime. And he thinks that everything that can distract him from his quest for immortality in his lifetime is a dangerous distraction. But he actually is not as much against religion as you could think reading the book. He's only against religion when it wants to stop the advancement of science.
Mm. Yes. Well, he's and I don't want to get too much into next week's show because I'm going to be talking about this all next week, but his stand against really anything that gets in the way of achieving his goal of immortality is simply that, look, either you're going to help me do this or you've got to get out of my way,
yeah,
or I will push you out of the way because I've got to get to this thing. Yeah.
Jethro is not a person, he's a symbol. It's something black and white.
Yes, absolutely.
That, it doesn't have to be taken as a story of human beings like us.
Right.
It's like, you know, an epic, it's like the Homer, the Odyssey.
Right. We're dealing with an archetype. He's there to symbolize a greater message. Well, I'll tell you, if I could get Zoe on the show, my first question to her would be, what do you see in Jethro anyway? Why do you want to spend your time with this guy? But we're almost completely out of time. And one thing I wanted to mention is that Julio, you're obviously going to be one of the 99 authors of the World Transformed, the abridged edition, the book of world-transforming ideas that we're putting together. And I wonder, what do you think after we complete that project, both the abridged edition and the ebook? Maybe we need to do a fiction project of similar stature, having people contribute fictional scenarios for the future that that might prove inspiring for others. What do you think?
This would be a great project. In fact, there is a similar project, I'm sure you must be aware of that, which is the Orion's ARM project.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's a collaborative world-building exercise of a coherent future galactic society. And there is a lot of material contributed to a lot of different people. It's really an amazing project. And now I think they are also writing science fiction novels based in the same universe, which makes a lot of sense. Because, you know, the background is already there.
Right.
And all the fans know the background already. Like, you know, I didn't mention one of the examples that I wrote in the blog, which is the Culture series
mm-hmm.
by Ian Banks.
Yes.
You know, he died a few months ago,
yes.
And he was really one of the
great loss
writers today. He's a great loss for everyone.
Yes.
And the Culture universe is has been outlined in 9 or 10 books, and they are all very good books. It's a very coherent universe. And, you know, what I was thinking is that, you know, based on the background, the fictional universe that has been already developed by Ian Banks,
mm-hmm.
which is a very interesting one, now that he is unfortunately dead, I believe other writers could step in and write other novels based in the same universe. And I think that would be a very good homage to the memory of Banks, and one which I'm sure he would appreciate.
I think he would approve of that very much, and that's a fantastic idea. Well, the time has just flown by, Julio. I wish that we had another hour that we could continue talking about this. And, in fact, we do have another hour, because what we'll do is we'll have you back on again soon, and we'll pick this discussion up. Thank you so much for your time.
I look forward to being with you again, of course.
Well, it's always great having you with us, and thank you so much for your time.
All right. Well, there it is. There's Julio Prisco on optimistic science fiction. Laid out some great examples, I think, there from the works of Arthur C. Clarke. We talked about some great stuff from Greg Egan. We talked a little bit about movies. We talked about some more contemporary, more transhumanist-themed fiction. Talked a little bit about Cory Doctorow. Looked at these current series of novels that are being developed around transhumanist themes, The Crux and Nexus by Ramez Nam, and his new one coming out very soon called Apex. And looked at The Transhumanist Wager, which, of course, we're going to be talking about next week. So a plethora of examples. They're not all of them necessarily all that optimistic, some of them with more optimistic themes emerging in fairly bleak stories. But in hearing all that, Stephen, what's your response? You've probably got some favorites that you'd like to lay out on us.
Well, yeah, I do, and I'm going to give my son some credit in helping me come up with these two examples that I'm about to give. I asked him right before the show. I said, "Son, give me some, what's some optimistic sci-fi that you enjoy?" And you know, don't give me Star Trek. That's too obvious. That's give me something a little more thought out than that, because everybody knows that Star Trek is an optimistic show. That's what they're known for.
Right.
And he said 2001: A Space Odyssey. Okay, and I said, okay, tell me why. He says, well, you know, we're out in the solar system, and we meet up with aliens that are far in advance of us, and there's not a fight. You know, they're not there to destroy us as they could easily do. They're there to help us. And that's
the fight wouldn't last long if we had a fight with those.
No, it would not have. Yeah.
Yeah,
and I said, okay, what's another example? And he said, well, it's, it's a totally different kind of thing, but Doctor Who. I said, well, okay, tell me why Doctor Who. He says, well, you know, no matter what trouble he gets into, he always is able to think his way out. There's some creative thing that he can do to undo the terrible thing that's going on. And he took issue with, you know, you say it's unrealistic. He says, in some ways it might be more realistic a spaceship like his than the Starship Enterprise. He says, you know, a spaceship that's bigger on the inside, it might be a little bit like what the aliens in 2001 Space Odyssey had, you know, a von Neumann type situation. It doesn't have quite the mass of a starship, but it's a whole lot easier to push through the universe. And so anyway, I thought that was an interesting discussion with my son right before.
Those are great points he makes. You know, Doctor Who, that show, the Doctor came up in the IO9 discussion in the comments, and some people were listing it as a great example of optimistic science fiction. Others arguing that it's not terribly optimistic because any of these stories that relies on kind of a hero to always step in and save you isn't really about, you know, humans being empowered and solving their own problems. But I think that really misses the point because he's an alien, okay? But he's an alien kind of the way Superman is an alien. We really know that Superman is a human who is realizing some of our ideals, right? And that's what the Doctor is,
yeah,
too. Granted, back in the 50s when they first conceived the show, they had to make him an alien because I don't think they had the idea of a post-human yet. I think if Doctor Who were written from scratch today, he'd just be a guy from the future. He would be a post-human from the future. He's a sexy immortal billionaire with superpowers is what he is, because he's human in every important sense other than the fact that he's got a couple of hearts, right? But you know, he's a guy whose job is to move through space and move through time and explore and understand things, and also to set stuff right. I agree. I think it's a fantastically optimistic set of stories. Not terribly friendly, actually, to transhuman themes frequently. One of my big complaints with that show, my daughter's a big Doctor Who fan, and one of my big complaints with that show is that any time, for example, life extension is brought into the story, it's always in a negative connotation, right? It's like whoever's seeking life extension is always a bad guy, and they're always, like, trying to do something.
Never mind that Doctor Who is centuries and centuries old, you know.
The Doctor gets to live forever, but we don't. Yeah, that's the bottom line. If it's okay for him, but if we want to, we're it's hubris, right? We're going beyond what we were intended to do. That's one thing that I dislike about the show. I just think they need to rethink that. And the other thing is, when they go to the really, really distant future, it's way too much like the present. I think they really need to rethink that on Doctor Who. But even then, I think it's a very, you know, in the first or second season of the, you know, the current series, when they started it back up in 05 or whenever that was, they go to, like, the end of time. I mean, it's, well, not the, I keep saying end of time. I should be more precise. I think, like, the death of the sun, okay? So whatever that is from now, 5 billion years from now. And the technology is ridiculously not advanced, okay? I mean, it's like these people should be – I mean, we should not have any idea what's going on because we shouldn't be able to conceive of these beings and what they're doing. But, okay, granted, so you have to show something. You have to make a show out of it. But ultimately, it's a pretty cheery future, you know? It's like we're all there. Everything has worked out. You know, humans have kind of ventured off into the galaxy and joined up with the rest of the galactic civilization. And swinging it back to the other we mentioned, 2001 A Space Odyssey, that's the cool thing about that, too, is not only do we not go to war with the aliens in 2001 A Space Odyssey, but we're invited to be part of this vast, universal civilization. You know, it's a story that says that not only are we going to make it, but others have made it, and there's a lot more to learn, there's a lot more to be seen, there's a lot more to be done in the universe than we can even begin to imagine, which is something that I personally believe is true whether there are aliens out there or not. But if there are, those are definitely the kind we want.
He mentioned one other, and I'm going to throw this one in too, the movie Contact. A lot of the same themes, that, you know, Carl Sagan's story that was made into a, I thought, a pretty good film a few years back. And optimistic themes. You know, again, joining a galactic civilization, not going to war with aliens like Independence Day or something like that, which was silly fun, but it was silly because, you know, if an alien civilization can get here, they can easily destroy us. So
Independence Day is a very entertaining movie, but I don't take it seriously as a vision of the future. And
no.
You know, if aliens are out there, they're like that. I'm sorry, I just have no respect for those aliens. Okay, they can just have us. Okay, just blow us up. I don't want to live in a galaxy with aliens that make
with aliens that stupid that
that's right,
feel
exactly.
like that they need to travel interstellar distances just to get our puny resources. Our puny resources.
Yeah, the one thing
give
that's
kind of
cool is even they don't seem completely clear on why they're there, which I kind of like that. It's like, well, okay, they just they're in a rut. These aliens. They just go from planet to planet, blowing things up. They don't know what else to do. But yeah, Contact is another great example. In fact, I don't know why you even bothered calling in, Stephen. Just have
Timothy. Yeah, I should have gotten Timothy on the call. Really should have.
He's the guy with the good ideas here. Not to spoil it. Okay, spoiler coming. If you haven't read the book Contact, you've had plenty of time to read the book Contact. But one of the most profound ideas that comes out in Contact, and it was the first place I had ever, I think, encountered this idea, is the simulation hypothesis occurs right at the end of Contact, and it's confirmed. Right, we learn that not only is there this vast civilization out there, but our universe itself was designed by some intelligence outside of and beyond even the intelligences that built the Stargates that nobody even knows who they are in that story. So it's a great kind of recursive. There's more to this story than meets the eye, and then there's even more to the story than meets the eye once you get to that point. I love that. I love that kind of turn in a story. And, yeah, I've always loved Contact for exactly that reason. It was a pretty good movie, too, wasn't it?
It was. It was. I don't think the movie dealt with that last theme at all, but it was, I thought, very well done. There's just a lot of ideas in Sagan's book. Sagan was awesome. Tip my hat to Carl Sagan, but that book in particular was a good one.
It truly was. Well, it's fun talking about this stuff, isn't it? Did you have any others that you wanted to throw in before we?
No. I'm going to let Timothy have the have my last word tonight. What about you, Phil?
Outsourcing there. As I was listening, I was trying to think if there was any big stuff I missed, and really the ones that that I always come back to are those. The first ones I talked about, those juvenile science fiction novels by Robert A. Heinlein. I don't know if those still hold up, but those were a great thing to have in my childhood. And I hope if those don't work for kids today, I hope there's something like them that gets young people as excited about space, as excited about the future as those books did to me. Because I think, going back to Julio's original point, it's really important. It's important that there be stories that are engaging and fun, which so much of our entertainment is engaging and fun, but that also really make people think, hey, you know, the future could actually be like this, and this is a future that's worth having and worth reaching for. So, I don't know. You've got younger kids. Are there any things aimed at kids that you know of that fit into that description?
Timothy was rocked recently when he read Ender's Game. Now, not a terribly optimistic vision of the future, except that, I mean, they were able to meet the challenge that was posed. But, you know, it kind of makes you stop. I don't want to, you know, everybody's about to go see that movie, so if I said more, I would spoil it. It's one of the best science fiction movies. Excuse me, science fiction books that I've ever read. I put it right up there with Dune, which was also a fantastic book, which they've tried to put on film a couple of times with mixed success. I love, because of its weirdness, the theatrical Dune, and the miniseries was sort of strange also, but the book itself was absolutely a masterpiece, and Ender's Game, much shorter, but equally a masterpiece. So, anyway, Are we out of time tonight, Phil?
That does it for tonight. I was just going to say, you know, Dune, not terribly optimistic, I suppose.
No, neither one of those that I mentioned just then were terribly optimistic, except that, you know, I mean, humanity somehow persists, you know, and even in the midst of these terrible things. So.
Well, we're continuing this discussion next week. I think that we started with disturbing futures last week, talking about optimistic science fiction this week, and next week we'll be talking about the transhumanist wager and what would you be willing to do to live forever and to gain omnipotence. That's the question we're going to be starting out with next week as we look at Zoltan Isfahan's fascinating novel, The Transhumanist Wager. So I hope everyone will be able to join us for that. I think the discussion is going to continue in a very interesting way. And speaking of interesting, Stephen, I know you've got some awesome music lined up for us this evening. What is that?
Yeah, this is one I had to listen to like five times before the show. I was enjoying it so much. Halloween Girl by Ghosts on the Radio.
Oh, fantastic. Seasonally appropriate, too. Halloween Girl by Ghosts on the Radio. Thanks for putting that together. Stephen, thank you all for being with us. We'll be back again, as I said, next week with Zoltan Isfahan talking about The Transhumanist Wager. And until next time, live to see it.